Hello and welcome to Radio EduTalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay, Scotland, and we're delighted to have on the show today Col Jones, who is at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, and we're going to be talking for the next 15 or 20 minutes about entrepreneurship education. Welcome to EduTalk, Col.
It's fantastic to be with you and your listeners, David.
Now, the weather is atrocious in Fife in Scotland today. Can you just describe your setting in Brisbane? I understand you've recently had a kind of significant move from another part of Australia.
That's right. I've moved from Tasmania, which is much more like Scotland, I suspect, than Queensland, to Queensland. They say up here that it's beautiful one day, perfect the next. it's very hot, and I think there's a bit of a thunderstorm raging on outside my house as we speak. So, I think the one word, tropical.
Oh, sounds great. I'm on my way already. Now, can you give us a kind of background to your career before we go into to talk about today's topic?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I did a talk, was part of a presentation last night where I said I did an overview of my life leading up from grade two through to now, and I think one of the key things that I really touched on was my terrible failures as a student from primary school through to high school, and that's where I finished. And then I became an entrepreneur across a range of different fields, and had lots of good days and eventually really big bad days, and I found myself becoming an academic by accident. I'd lost about $1 million and I had to try and find a way to get it back. The only way to get it back was to become what they call, to get legal aid, so a government-sponsored lawyer, so I could fight a court case. And the only way to get that was to be either a student or be unemployed. So I enrolled at University of Tasmania and, completed my degree, didn't get to really get into court, lost my money. But it was offered a job as an educator, and so very much an accidental career. But I entered it, I think, with a big advantage. I'd always been such a bad student. I'd come to realise that many students struggle in the classroom. They hide. They've got the people who are flying through and the people who are really struggling. And so I already had this sort of natural inclination that not everyone in the class is going to get it the same way. So my teaching philosophy is quite developed, but essentially you could describe it as being about offering people choice, offering students choice in how they engage in the curriculum, how they respond to it, how they demonstrate their learning, which I find incredibly interesting, David, because it means I'm always getting something interesting given to me. It's not just the same standards there.
And you're a prolific writer, as I understand, and can you just take us through some of your kind of recent publications, whether that's academic papers or books?
Yeah, so I publish a lot on entrepreneurship education, and we actually tend to call it enterprise education, which is really from the UK. My colleagues, Andy Penaluna, Kath Penaluna, and Harry Matlay from the UK, we tend to differentiate between entrepreneurship education as being something that you would be doing if you're wanting to help people to start a business, enterprise education, which is about giving them all those foundational skills in creative thinking, idea generation, idea testing, working in teams, solving problems, all of that, really the sort of what we call those sort of employability skills, enterprising skills. And so there's an overlap between those two things, but my publications tend to sort of lean towards the enterprise education side of the spectrum. And the main focus of my publications of recent time has been focusing on this idea of pedagogy. This may be quite a new word to many of your listeners, but pedagogical learning is self-determined learning. So it's where we start with a student first. Students interact with an environment, the educator, the institution, and we're asking our student, what is it that you're interested in? What would you like to do? And then we're trying to wrap our curriculum around that area of student interest rather than predetermining in advance, pedagogically making decisions in advance on behalf of students. And then we meet them in the middle, where you sort of say, well, andragogically, we want you to become a self-directed learner, taking on this responsibility, and we work out how we're actually going to get that student's interest to actually move forward. So this has been a lot of fun in sort of developing our thinking around this particular area, and I think it's going to continue on. I think it's really opening eyes and getting people to sort of think about the difference between having an educator make a range of decisions on behalf of students in advance of actually meeting them, and actually asking students what they're interested in, what they're passionate about, and then how can we actually help them to pursue those passions whilst wrapping our aspects of our curriculum around their particular passions.
And I wonder how possible it is within constraints in universities and schools to actually teach the kind of transferable skills and a kind of pedagogical approach to, you know, can you give us some examples of where, you know, teachers and tutors, etc., have actually managed to be successful in that approach, and, you know, what constraints remain in 2016 to actually get to this? Sounds like an ideal way of teaching and learning.
Well, yeah, you're right. There definitely are constraints, but they're more constraints of the mind than they are anything else. When we, you know, try to create frameworks of rigour, maybe because it's for accreditation or industry standards, one of the challenges is, you know, what was it that we wanted our students to learn, and have we been able to assess that they learned it? How we actually made that happen really should be less of a concern than did the learning actually occur. And I think that's where we need to reset the agenda. We need to be sort of asking the question, well, regardless of what they did, assuming no one got hurt, did the learning occur? Okay, so if it has occurred, give it a tick, and now let's go back and ask ourselves that next question, and that is it actually appropriate the way that learning was being done? Now, if there's a problem, there's a problem. But I think we have to just put our trust in educators. I think the best educators that I meet around the world, they're not crazy people. They just have boundaries that they want to push on behalf of their students. And I think that's the critical thing here. Innovative educators aren't innovative educators because they're bored and they're trying to do something a little bit different. They're doing it because they think they can improve the outcomes for their students. And so it's finding ways to have those conversations with the higher order decision makers, institutions, and get them to realise. I mean, I think what we found is that pedagogical learning is something that we retrofit. It's just a title. It's just a descriptor. There are already educators all around the world who are using a pedagogical approach. They just get bashed up for it because they're living in a pedagogical world. So one of the challenges we've got, and I've got a new paper coming out very soon in an Irish education journal, is thinking about the language that we need to be able to use. If we keep using the word pedagogy to catch everything that relates to teaching, then it's very hard to actually get pedagogical learning in and get people to take it seriously. If we can actually introduce self-determined learning, the circumstances when it would be appropriate and when wouldn't it be appropriate. So it's not about trying to take over the world of a new way. It's just trying to sort of say, well, there are times when it would be best suited for students to have that freedom and to be given an opportunity to fail, you know, in a structured and supported way. And that's, I think, a lot more beneficial for people than simply just struggling, bashing their head against the wall, and we give them 50% pass and then move them on. It's much better off to let them fail in the first week and then try to actually work out why they fail, and hopefully by the end of the year they're going heaps better. And it might just be because they needed a different way to learn, you know, engage with the subject matter. It naturally fits with enterprise learning. But at the same time, David, I think enterprise learning is something that's becoming, it's seeping in to all areas of education. So if someone wants to be an architect, or they want to be a sociologist, they want to be a writer, then they need to sort of develop that sort of enterprising mindset, because they could end up being a freelancer. They could end up having to create content as a journalist and get out there and market it. They might have to, you know, draw up designs for people, but not be employed to do it, but, you know, do it through freelancing. So I think the world of education is changing beneath our feet, and the change is being sort of ushered in by the students' feet. And the challenge for us is to be able to respond in a way that actually satisfies them less than satisfies the constraints of the institution we're in.
I mean, there's a lot of discussion among educators in Scotland about, you know, the idea of failure and about it possibly being a good thing. Some people are quite uncomfortable with that, about, you know, the idea that you're only getting one shot at education and, you know, you might fall behind. And it's tied in with the kind of growing research and chat around resilience. But are you comfortable with it because you come from an entrepreneurial background, where one would assume, you know, failure rates of startups in Australia will be similar to the UK, i.e. it's a phenomenal rate of attrition?
Yeah, look, I think if you look at you've got some credible educators. I've met a lot of brilliant educators in Scotland. Carol Langston, who runs the Scottish Entrepreneurship Educators program, which I've been lucky enough to teach into on a few occasions. And the difference is that when we talk about the word failure, we're really just talking about a disappointing outcome. So we're not talking about a code that's going to be applied to the outcome of someone's study. So somebody does an accounting subject, and at the end of the year, the teacher says, well, they got 40 out of 100 for their final mark. So that's a failure, right? So they failed the subject. When we use the word failure, we're saying, well, within the context of that subject, and maybe for something that's worth 5 or 10 marks, we want to set you a challenge. And we want the student to actually show the motivation to go off and do something. And if they come up short, then it's like, okay, so, you know, you only got 4 out of 10 for that particular thing. How do you feel about that? What do you think you could do to have another go at it? And so it's never really about the one shot. It's really about multiple goes, but it's actually about getting people to overcome their concerns about failure. I mean, if you walk into a music class, then good music educators deal with failure every day. It's their bread and butter. You've got a kid, he's holding a guitar, he wants to be Jimi Hendrix. He knows what Jimi Hendrix sounds like, and he's playing it terribly, right? So he can either kid himself and say, I'm Jimi Hendrix, I'm that good, or he can say, there's a standard that I recognise I want to achieve, and at the moment I'm failing to get to that standard. It doesn't mean he gets kicked out of the class. He just recognises it as a necessary step to improve incrementally every time he's having a class, every time he's moving forward. And so I find good music teachers use failure and getting students to appreciate their inability to reach a particular level as the motivator to get them to the next level. So I think we don't want to demonize the word, and we don't want to sort of think we're going to be crushing somebody. I think the real failure in education is to leave someone bobbing along at 55% in a class, when actually we could have offered them different ways to engage with that material and get them much, much higher. I think it's the educators who are failing the students, not the students who always fail when they get that 50 or 40%. But that's maybe a way I would view it, as somebody, not necessarily from an entrepreneurial perspective, but as someone who has had their own battles with education and learning and would have appreciated to have been able to bring my own passions into the classroom and to have maybe engaged in a conversation about how else I might like to have engaged with particular subject areas, like maths. If somebody had said, let's go outside and count cricket balls and cricket stumps, I might have enjoyed maths more than just seeing it as numbers on a white page.
You've mentioned before earlier on there about the kind of difference between enterprise education and entrepreneurship education. So if I take it, enterprise education kind of sits within maybe undergraduate courses and within schools. You know, what what's the kind of key content, you know, in 2016? And I did business studies at school 26 years ago. I'd imagine quite a lot hasn't changed, but at the same time, you know, is it all about social media and marketing now, or what other kind of concepts have worked their way into the courses?
You're asking a really interesting question, one that I get asked quite often, David. And the way I tend to answer it is in a fairly abstract way, and that is to say, you know, I've got three children, and I love them dearly, but we're never going to get married. You don't need to have marriage as a necessary precondition to demonstrate love. And you don't need business to actually demonstrate your ability to be an enterprising person. And so what we try to do is we try to strip business right away from it. We just remove it totally and just get the kids thinking about problems that matter to them. So maybe someone's got a skateboard park that doesn't exist in the local town and they like to get together with their mates, and it's like, okay, how would we get a skateboard park to be approved and funded? And then it's like working through that process with them. I met some teachers from a college here in Australia last night in Brisbane, and they're very, very excited about getting together and doing some work. Now, the funny thing is they're very passionate English teachers, and they've got a writing program. They're very excited about that uptake of how many students have been coming in and participating in this writing project. And so my first conversation to them was, okay, how many of them have published it on Amazon? And it's like, none of them have. And it's like, okay, well, that's what we could do with enterprise education. We could show them how to set up an account, either with their parents or by themselves. We could show them how to think about that book being published online. And then if they wanted to know more about marketing the book, we could do that as well. But they don't need to set up a business. They don't need to, you know, be a registered business owner. They can become a published author whose work is available on Amazon. And it can be that simple. Enterprise education can just simply bob along at that level, and it doesn't need to sort of be thinking about, you know, I'm going to scale up my idea and take over the world. That's more the domain of enterprise education, of entrepreneurship education, sorry. And we really just want enterprise education to be something that which can help people follow their dreams. And those dreams can be very varied, from something they want to do in their local community, something they want to do themselves personally, or could actually be something that the school wants to do, that the students are actually motivated for because they feel like they're missing out on something, some resource in that school.
You're talking with great passion, Colin. I'm just wondering where the blog and particularly the podcast fit within your kind of vision of your role as an educator. I mean, the way you've spoken over the last 20 minutes or so, you know, sounds like you've got a story to tell, and you've, you know, almost feel like you've got a kind of coaching role that could touch on others through the use of social media. So can you just take us through your thinking behind the blog and the podcast, and you know, what you're hoping, the kind of support that you're hoping to give to other educators, other people worldwide?
Well, look, the podcast is it mostly needs a little bit more focus. It is towards educators, and it's towards students, and it's towards institutions, I suppose, education institutions. It's called The Reason with Ventura. It's got a website, thereasonwithventura.com. And it's really the notion of the reasonable adventurer is just a graduate capable of creating their own opportunities for satisfaction. So I'm really just talking around issues and topics, things that enable, things that suppress those abilities of people to actually create opportunities and pursue them and execute them, you know, in their own lives. I've written a couple of books recently. I'm writing one at the moment, but got a 30-minute train ride every morning, which I'm really enjoying because we don't have trains in Tasmania. So now I'm in Queensland, I actually get a relaxed drive into work on a train. The first book I wrote recently, and this is e-books I'm talking about, not academic books, was called A Stone That Gathered Moss. And it was really just a reflective journey of me moving from being very young and not very good at school through to developing sort of fairly insatiable appetite for thinking, so that metacognition, thinking about my thinking and helping other people to think in that space as well. And I'm currently writing a book at the moment called The Naked Educator and Lessons Learned, which hopefully in the next 2 weeks I'll get it out online. And that's really just looking back at the last 14 years of all the really funny things that have happened in the classroom between me and my students, or my students and the students. And I'll have to get that edited a bit, I think, just to make sure that some of the stories are appropriate for publication. But I think at the end of the day, Tucker J. Palmer, who's a great educator from the States, he said, you know, we teach who we are. And I think the best thing that every educator can do is just to be comfortable with who they are and then to understand what that means. If they're really good at the detail, if they're really good at helping people to sort of make sure that they can follow that process, then be the best you can be of that. If they have that sort of inspirational sort of air to them and they've got a way of filling up the sort of the air in people's tyres, then do that. And we don't all have to be, you know, you can't reduce teaching to technique. You can't all just find the right technique and just do it and say, well, I'm doing the technique 1, 2, 4, 5, therefore I must be a great educator. And you're right, I very much enjoy getting around the world and talking with people. And ultimately, people have been learning the same way for a couple of thousand years. And it's just the circumstances that get created that either sort of enable that learning to move forward profitably or actually restrict people. And I think most people who are born on the planet, unless they've got some form of disability, actually have a clean run of being able to learn. They just don't all have the same run. That's the problem. And institutions tend to want to sort of everyone has to do it the one way. And I think half the problem in education occurs just from that. I think once we give our students choice, choice that we can manage, and that, you know, and we don't worry about everyone having exactly the same opportunity, then all of a sudden, you know, students buy in and bring their own passions.
Colin, it's been lovely having you on the show today, and best wishes for the future. Just before you go, could you give us a couple of kind of key links then, whether it's about your presence online or current projects that you're working on?
Yeah, look, my books can be found on Amazon. So if you go to Amazon Kindle and you type in The Stone That Gathered Moss, in the next couple of weeks, if you type in The Naked Educator, you'll find that there. Those books will also be highlighted on my own website, which is just teaching-entrepreneurship.com. And that's pretty easy to find. If you just type in teaching entrepreneurship, you'll find that website. Google looks after that site pretty well. As I say, the podcast can be found at thereasonadventurer.com. And always interested in feedback and always interested to have conversations with people around the world. So if any of your listeners want to engage in a conversation, then, you know, contact me. It's easy to find me through those websites, and let's have a chat.
Thanks again, Cole. Best wishes, and we'll hopefully speak again in the future.